Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello. So this is exciting today. Misha, absolute powerhouse.
You played with her, haven't you?
I've written songs with her. I've played at the Albert Hall with her.
What did you do at the Albert Hall?
She got up and sang with David Gilmour. She did Great Gig in the Sky.
Oh, amazing. When was that?
When was it? 2015, I think.
When
we used to do gigs.
You played with everybody, haven't you?
The great and the near great. I've known them all.
Yeah, but listen, Misha's wonderful. I mean, not only is she, you know, really brought gospel to the fore. And I mean, she did this fantastic documentary recently for BBC Four on the history of gospel.
But just an incredible cast list of people that she's, you know, I mean, it's she's had one of those kind of, oh, my God, pinch myself careers, hasn't she?
Yeah. Rod Tepton, Narada Michael Walden, Prince. Oh, Prince. Yeah. I really want to get those stories out of her. Should we do that?
Let's do that. Welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rockonteurs podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hi, darling. I'm not technical. Wait.
Hey!
Sorry, I look like shit. Okay, I love you.
You look amazing. Hello, Misha.
Bless you. I basically went and walked the dog. I thought it was just audio, so I thought I'll be all right.
But that's a fantastic look. That's a fantastic look. Nice to see you.
Mad, but yeah, it's all good. I'm here.
Me and Guy don't look great. So we never
Bless you. Bless you. How are you, babes?
We're good. I'm good. It's a few years since I saw you, since you were down here in Brighton.
It's been a really, really long time. And can you see me? There you go. Yeah. Brighton, what's that? 4 years
ago, something, yeah.
Yeah, right?
That was fun. God, it was great fun, that.
Babe, listen, that was so good.
I get so bored with these podcasts because especially everyone comes on Guy's played with or has had someone, you know, something to do with Big Bass on. What did he do with you, Misha?
He's very good. My God. He's a very talented man. We were working with the Freemasons from memory.
Yeah, it was the idea. It was a disco project. And the idea was it was meant to be like this sort of a box of lost tapes found from the power station in 1979. It was a great lost Bernard and Nile project.
We
came up with about three or four songs, which are great. But then
the songs were really good, actually. And it's just a shame we haven't done anything with them because were really, really good. But they were brilliant. But you know how these things are.
I like the artistic concept. You're trying to do songs that sound like lost tapes and they actually do get lost.
Yes. Yeah. We're method. We're absolutely method. We don't mess about. Yeah, yeah. And we lost them.
And how has all your year been? You had an album out, I know, and a documentary out. But what's the reality of it? Because a lot of that must have been recorded before, I'm sure.
No, it wasn't actually. I tell you what happened. I made that album in 3 weeks. Literally, I made the album in 3 weeks. And it was when the first lockdown stopped. We had that window, if you remember, in September. Mm-hmm. And I literally got everybody in and Brian Rawlings produced it. And, you know, I just went back to the old days, you know, how church was for me when I was growing up. You know, we didn't have this kind of new sound in gospel music that you get now, this contemporary sound. It was proper old school, you know, and I remember that and I prefer that gospel. So I went with that approach with the album instead of going for the new sort of sound.
You need to explain that a bit more, I think, because I'm not sure the difference between the old school and the new school.
Ah, okay. Well, the new school is what you would probably say is like Kirk Franklin. You know Kirk Franklin? Kirk Franklin.
I want to say, like, yes.
Mary Mary?
Yeah. Okay.
Mary Mary Shackles. You remember that song? That contemporary gospel sounds like any sort of R&B record is the way to put it.
I know what you mean.
Whereas my old school gospel lineage sort of comes from the real, like, Oh Happy Day, that was a hit in the 70s. And that's the kind of gospel I come from, the old school.
And so what, this was a church, was it in Lewisham, right? Wasn't it where you started singing?
Yeah, I grew up, well, basically, I was born in Islington. That's why I'm still a Gooner. But we
come on, come
there.
On, come on, come on. Well, you can't just say that. I'm an Islingtonian. You know, that's my roots. What road, what street did you live on?
Tollingdon.
Is that? Oh, I don't know that, but I know the name now. Where is that going? Yeah.
Gary, come on.
Is it going towards Dalston, Newington Green? What area is that?
No, it's going more towards Dalston, I think. I'm not very, you know, I'm really bad. Honey, I was like five. I know the road, though, because I've seen it a few times when I've been on my travels. But yeah, it's definitely there. It's been there. It was there before me, Gary, honestly.
I remember. No, Tollington Road.
She did a song called South of the River, not North of the River. You know what I mean?
I know. Well, you know what happened, right? You know what happens, right? Basically, my grandparents, who brought me up with my sister and stuff, they basically moved from Islington to Broccoli, which is in South London, Lewisham, right? Because you could get more for your money there. And so they went and got this massive house down in Broccoli. And then I was moved.
It's leafy, isn't it? It's really leafy.
Yeah, it's
I'm a South Londoner
really
myself. So
yeah.
You're a Transpontidian. Isn't that? I heard that. I think George Melly said that. I'm sure I've got the word right.
Well, I'm glad you know it, because I'm not going to try and say it.
Well, we'll talk about your gospel album in a bit, I think. We need to get your gospel roots first, because that's your real background. So you're going to church on a regular basis, I take it.
Listen, baby, we went to church 7 days a week.
No.
Okay.
What?
Yeah, listen, let me tell you how it works. With us, it was choir practice, prayer meetings. It was a Bible study. And then we'd have prayer meetings in the house. And there was just every day there was an event. That you didn't have a moment to get bored, put it that way. You couldn't get bored in my house.
Or to feel that someone wasn't watching you. I mean, that's kind of what you're being told, right?
What faction? What bit of the church? Which arm of the church was your family?
My family is New Testament. So New Testament Church of God.
Oh, so that's a church. Okay.
Yeah, New Testament is a body, right? You got some people that are Baptist. You got some people. Yeah, mine New Testament Church of God. Very big, actually. They're all over the UK. They're everywhere. Scotland, everywhere. And they have also these big sort of conventions, they call them, every year, where everyone sort of packs into like places like Leicester, De Montfort Hall, places like Wembley, and they have big conventions, like all the bodies come together and have these. I mean, it's a big organization.
Wow, just like Ali Pali all day.
It's that kind of, but with Jesus as the, you know. And then they had like these kind of X Factor style events too at those conventions. So I was, you know, my first sort of big gig was in Wembley.
Wow.
I was 11 years old and I went in for the competition and I won. And I was 11. And, you know, what was quite interesting about that was a lot of the contestants, they weren't even my age. They were all different ages. So it was one of the things where it wasn't like everyone was young like me. There were some people who were like 25 but anyway, so I won it. My grandparents were ecstatic. And then I won the award for best singer that year at 11. And that's kind of like where it all started. My grandmother was like my agent, my grandparents. They would just take me to every New Testament church around the UK. And I was known as this little girl with the big voice.
You're saying it started when you were 11 at Wembley. For us, it ended at Wembley. That was it. That was where. Once you'd done that, that was it.
No. You never say it's over till the fat lady sings.
I took my 11-year-old boy to see Santana. This is years ago at Wembley. And we're in Wembley Arena. And I'm saying, look around you, son. You know, I've played here 14 times, you know. Could you imagine being on that stage, playing in front of all these people? Yeah. And Santana has this thing where he gets all the kids to get up on stage at one point. And
Mike
is suddenly on stage playing a tambourine. And he comes off. He just literally gets handed up onto the stage. He comes off.
Very lucky.
That wasn't too bad, Dad. You know, listen, your grandparents must have thought you were
a secret weapon to get them onto the top table in the Church of God. I mean,
well, that's really what it was. Yeah, it was that. You got it. And I mean, I didn't know that at the time. I was just like, I was the busiest little girl you'd ever known about. You know, I was literally, I was at school in the daytime. And then afterwards, I was running off with my grandparents in the car, driving all around the UK. And, you know, and in between that, I was Oliver in school every year. I was always Oliver. It was just, I just knew that I spent, like, when I was 8 years old, my auntie, because remember, my grandparents had their children at home still at that point. And my auntie used to import all these gospel records from the States. And I used to, you know, if you've ever been into a Jamaican house, you will know that the front room is like a shrine. Like literally, it, you know, the seats are covered with plastic things on the sofa so that, you know, there's no dirt on them. I mean, it's proper. Like,
what, no one's allowed in there in case the mayor comes round or something.
Babe, you know, it's actually waiting for the mayor the whole time. Yeah. You know, it's that. And it's totally ready. You know, it's on point. There's nothing that needs to be done. So I had to sort of tiptoe in there and, you know, pretend that, you know, I'd have to watch that no one was around. And I'd put on that my aunt's records without anybody knowing. I was 8, you know, but I was obsessed with the sound of the Hawkins family, who were the ones who later on had a hit with Oh Happy Day. They had some amazing records. And I used to listen to the record and I used to ad-lib. I used to practice the ad-libbing of the singers on that record at 8. By the time I got to 9 and a half, 10, I could do a riff like Aretha, everybody, you name it, I was on it.
I've always bore people the same stories, but I had this wonderful experience when I was doing The Bodyguard with Whitney Houston. I used to sit in the makeup trailer at 6 a.m. and she used to sing gospel while she was having her makeup done. I mean, that was her warming up. You know, to be honest, I never found the right harmony to join in.
What a lovely woman. Yeah. My goodness.
When I knew her, before she became Troubled, I knew the best of Whitney in a way. You know, did you work with her?
No, you know what? I worked with Bobby, you know, but basically before she met with Bobby, Bobby and I had done a track together that didn't come out as well. But anyway, but before that, she invited me. I did a show with her. You know, back in the day, you used to do this Top of the Pop show in Germany. Don't ask me the name of it, but it was their sort of pop show.
I do remember that.
There were all those weird German shows. They were all weird.
Tommy's
Yeah. And you know, you went over there. You went over there for the night. And you stayed there and did the show and then you flew out the next day or the day after, whatever. And she and I were on the same show. And this is when I literally just released my One Temptation, just got it out. And I remember being in the green room, you know, as you do, you're waiting. And I had my one little record company guy from Island Records, you know, because Island Records then was tiny. I mean, they were really small.
That's super cool with Chris Blackwell running it still. And
sick. Baby, don't get me started on that. That was weird. That's where it was at. But you know, it was very daunting when you saw other acts with big labels come in with the equipment and think, wow, I could do that. So I was sat there in the green room and then all of a sudden this massive limo comes by and I look out and I'm like, wow, that's a big car. Who's that? And remember, I'm 18 and I'm literally just getting in the game. God. And there was all these bodyguards that walked out. But there was Whitney and they came into the room and I never forget the first moment I saw her, I was like, this woman is better looking in real life than any picture that I'd seen of her. She's absolutely beautiful. Just gorgeous, gobsmacking gorgeous. You know, that way where you're sort of like, my gosh, I'm not even gay. And I'm looking at her like, damn, you know, she's like hot. And then she was so sweet. She was giving me vibes and I didn't know.
Oh my God, your whole life journey. Why didn't you just give into it?
I didn't know. Babe, trust me. You know, when you just come out of church, remember, I just came out of church, you know. Yeah. So you know how they are with that. You know, the churches back then, trust me. No, this is wrong. That is against. You know, it was like that. So I'm in there and I'm not seeing it. Not seeing that she's into me like that at all. It wasn't until she was just so sweet and lovely. And then they invited us for dinner. And it was when we went for dinner after the taping, she started playing Footsie Under the Table.
Oh, my God. And hang on, though. Was Robin not with her? Robin was her girlfriend.
Robin was there. Robin was, oh, my God. I even ended up going to Robin's, you know, a couple of years later in New Jersey. She's got a beautiful place. She's such a nice person.
Yeah.
And, you know, my belief is if she was allowed to stay with Whitney would still be here today. That's my view.
Yeah. Because I really got on. Robin was her manager and lover.
Robin's great, man.
A really powerful woman and so impressive, but still probably, you know, allowed Whitney to play footsie under the table with you.
Yeah. Well, exactly. You see, by that point, they didn't really have a relationship by then. I think it had been over by then. By then, it was business and friendship sort of thing. They'd already done that. You know, it was already, that was gone.
The interesting point you raised just there, Misha, when you said I'd just come out of the church. And like, because so many great soul singers came from gospel and then had this terrible moment where they switch over to secular and they get untold grief and, I'm going to burn in hell. Did you have to go through that?
I went through hell. I was going through hell in the church before I even left. I mean, in the church, remember, I was becoming this really big star in the church and they were questioning the style of music I was singing. I mean, I thought the Hawkins family music then was seen as racy. Like I'm telling you about the contemporary sound of gospel now, right?
Because
they were like, their stuff sounded like Earth, Wind and Fire, but gospel. It was killing, you know? And I was just like, oh yeah, I love that. That's great. I love that. And I was singing it in church and they were like, we don't know about that kind of music, you know? You don't sound godly, you know? So I was getting heat from them. And then I thought, you know what? I'd been up, you know, I'm 15, 16 now, and I'm getting like, you know what? My dad's coming at the weekend, picking us up at weekends and playing Marvin Gaye. He's playing the Isley Brothers. He's playing Gil Scott-Heron. Oh. And I'm sat there in the car and I'm going, no, you know what? The gospel thing's cool, right? It's cute, but I need to go here.
let me just ask you about that. So you weren't living with your dad. Did that make that music even more attractive, that your dad lived this mysterious life outside of you?
Because my dad would come at weekends and you know, and I'd see my parents at the weekends and stuff. But when my dad would come, it wasn't just that. It was an education. My dad is, I mean, I get everything from him in terms, I'm not even as bright as him. My dad is my dad's written like 3 books. He's a singer. He plays the flute, the trumpet. He's a painter. You know, he's one of those people that you're annoyed about because he's good at everything. And but he's a real educational type of dude, yeah. So he's the guy. He will sit down and say, yeah, you know, when Gil Scott wrote this album, he give you the history, the time, the zone. It was an education in the car, and he would be driving through London, and he'd always take us up to the, you know, Hyde Park, and we'd always go, you know, where you row the boats and stuff like that, and you know where you got the art along the wall. That's where my dad would take us at weekends, and we'd go on the boats, and so it was such an amazing event every weekend with my dad coming from that rigid sort of church thing every minute. It was like, you know, it was an amazing experience. And so when he would leave and drop us off and give us loads of money, which felt like loads of money back then, I would take my money and I would run to Red Records. And I remember tiptoeing up like that because it was so high up the thing. And I would say, oh, can I get Tom Brown, please? That new one from Jamaica. And there you go. Give him the money and run home and hide the album under the bed. And play it when no one was around. And then the next weekend, it would have been Prince. It was like, I don't know, what was the first record I bought of Prince? It was the one where he's in a...
Dirty Mind was the first one.
Yeah, that's it. And he had the thing on, you know, the stilettos with suspenders.
Yeah.
And the Rude Boy badge. He actually had a two-tone badge.
Yeah, that's really going to be allowed in your house, right?
Honey, you know, I hid that one for dear life. Let me tell you, that was right at the bottom of the bed. You're not
fair. It was a Jazz Mags, wasn't it?
Exactly. And so, you know, that was the kind of thing I had to do, but it was a tug between staying in the church and venturing out. I had that moment where I was like, I knew I had to make a decision, you know?
But if you were living with your grandmother and she's your sort of church agent, I mean, how is that, you know, how is that? That's, you'd have to be really strong to do that.
Well, it was tough because I, you know, basically, I'm trying to give you everything condensed quickly because it's such a long story.
We want
the whole story. Okay, fine. So basically what happened is that dad would come and influence me now, and I'd start hearing other types of music and being in love with it and thinking, it's really Marvin was the big clincher for me. That was my real, like, I need to get out of this gospel thing now, right? But it was also the church getting annoyed at me for singing music that was a little bit racy. That was annoying me a bit because I was like, well, if it's all God's music, what's the point? I was that kid that was always arguing about what's wrong with gay people, what's wrong with... And my grandparents said, well, the Lord said it was that. I was that kid. And I used to drive them nuts. So anyway, what happened?
Did they blame your dad? Did they blame your dad?
No, they didn't. They didn't, because you see, he was just weekends. They didn't blame him. It was just, they were strict. It was just that kind of thing. They were really strict, and they didn't say anything about him or my mum, or the fact that they were living like in sin, because, you know, for them, having a party was living in sin. You know, my mum and dad, they love their parties at weekends. Let me tell you, that house was transformed. You know what I mean? It was like, it was party. So, you know, they would just say, just make sure you come home on time. And, you know, that lifestyle that your parents is living, you can't have that here. It was that high. And it was, you know, but I loved my grandparents, because they were fantastic. But at that time, I was on a rebellious chat. I was just like, I've got to get out of here.
But you know, but I think there's great value in the fact that you were brought up singing. I think the reason it's so important in that religious community is when you sing, you transport yourself. And if you're connecting great spiritual belief with your voice, then I think your voice can transcend anything that an actor could do. Your belief in it, and secular gave you that ability to tune in. Marvin, for example, is singing a kind of powerful religious statement. If you're not religious, but a powerful statement when he's talking, singing what's going on. You know, that whole environmental album.
Sure, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, look, the fundamental thing about coming from the church is that you're always taught from the beginning that this is not yours. Your service to humanity. Right. That's, you know, when I found out, when my grandmother discovered I could sing, I was like six, and I was singing Rupert the Bear around the house, and she just was like freaking out and jumping up and down, telling everyone on the phone, Michelle, I'm a voice. Oh God, she got a great voice. We're going nuts. And then she was just like, you got to tell, you know, you got to sing in church every weekend. And that's really how it all started. But she always said to me, God give you a gift. And my granddad would say as well, it's not for yourself. This is to touch and bless other people with it. And you are raised with that. It's ingrained. So it's never seen as, I did this. It's always, this is a gift and I have to honor it. So when you have that sort of selfless mindset, any song that you sing, you're going to sing it different to other people. You just, you know, because you're not even in it. Maybe I'm there for the first two lines. First two lines of the song, I'm there. After that, see ya. Lift off.
Channeling.
Wow.
Gone.
That's extraordinary. We should move on to when you know, your first experiences in studios.
When I started to sort of pull away from the church at this point, I'm starting to pull away. My sister's apartment in Brixton is looking great to move to from Broccoli. It's what was going on. And my bass player mate, who I used to write with in church, you know, I told you this guy, I'm obsessed with bass. You know, yeah, I love it.
I know.
Paul Powell.
Oh, please.
Sorry, Gary. And I used to get with Paul Powell. Paul Powell was a really big bass player on the scene back in the day. And he and I used to do demos on the side, outside of the church knowing. And those demos was picked up by a guy who was managing my gospel group at that time called Viv. And we sent those demos off to the record company. And, you know, I got signed at 18 to Island Records, as you know.
Yeah.
And they put all these, they had a meeting, and I was in the room, and there was about seven suits in there. All men, you know, suits, obviously, but now suits, anyone can wear them. But back then it was all blokes. And I was sat there, and I was like, I remember my dad always saying to me, you know, whenever you're in a room with lots of really powerful people, always behave like you're not impressed about it. You know, my dad gave me the whole rundown about that. Just act it. Act like you're not intimidated and own that room. My dad was that guy, right? So I was doing everything he told me to do, even though deep down I was terrified. And I remember the tapes they put on the table, and they said, what do you like? And out of all these tapes I was listening to, there was one song. It was a demo of Breathe Life Into Me. And it was sung by this girl. And I don't know who it was. But the minute I heard that song, I said, I want to work with these guys. Who are these guys? Who are these guys? Then they got them. And it was Pete Vale and Mick Leeson who wrote Morning Train for Sheena Easton, wrote Justice for Lamar, Charles and Eddie, Would I Lie to You? I mean, the list goes on.
Tell me about those guys. Who were they? What was their, were they?
Well, the big hit was Morning Train with Sheena Easton. That's how Sheena Easton got her first hit. That was her first massive hit before she did For Your Eyes Only. And I just fell in love with Breathe Life Into Me. But if I hadn't chosen that song, and those guys, I wouldn't have got my One Temptation, which was written five months later. and I remember, you know, I just had my first heartbreak with my little boyfriend who I thought was the love of my life. And I was telling him, oh, he's got another girlfriend. The minute I signed the record contract, that was it. He changed. And then he said, you know, he was like my, you know, my surrogate dad. And then basically we sat there talking about this boy. And then it became My One Temptation. That's how the song came about.
Oh, there you go.
It was about him, yeah.
And who were the players on that? Did you stick with your bass player?
Yeah, Paul. Paul's all over that album, Paul Powell. And then, he did loads of... He might have even played for you guys at one point. Paul was with everyone. Deacon Blue, he was... Scritti Politti, he was playing for everyone. Cross, he was with everyone. You remember him, innit, guys?
Now, yeah, I remember.
We just had some bloke called Martin Kemp playing bass for us. That was it.
No, but you know what I mean. I mean, yeah. He was around.
He was very much around, yeah.
Yeah.
Because everything then happened pretty fast, didn't it? You were off and running.
Yeah, the thing about it was so fast. We just made the record in a couple of months and then they put it out and then it went straight top 10. I mean, it was, and just before the record came out, I got invited to a Prince concert at Camden Palace.
Right.
And he had a private...
I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, and he had a private concert. So imagine, I'm getting ready to drop the first record, but I haven't released the record yet. It's just coming. It's building up, you know? And no one knows about me yet. And I get the golden ticket to go to this private show. Remember, I'm in love with this Prince.
Was this one of his post shows? Sort of, where he'd do a show in London and then go and do another show at Camden.
Yeah. And it was, and it was a very private show. I mean, literally, it was a golden ticket. If you had a ticket for that, you were just like made. And I remember calling up my best mate and saying, you've got to come with me. You never guess what? I got a Prince ticket. Oh my gosh. And we went down there. Remember, we dressed to the nines. My shoes were killing me that day. I'll never forget it. It's one of them things. And we stood there. We walk in and it's packed. You got Bono was there, Mickey Rourke, Ronnie Wood. Every A-list person was in that room, let me tell you. Did I care about them? No. All I cared about was him.
Didn't you see me as you were going in the door? I was going, Misha, Misha, get me in. Did you see?
You didn't need me then. No way. You didn't
he had his
me.
Phone. He's going to talk to my mum.
No, he was massive. No. Basically, we managed to get right to the front, which was really cool. And we squeezed our way in, you know. And we stood there and he took ages to come. And then finally he came on and I was gone. The shoes stopped hurting me. Everything was just... I was in heaven. I just saw the guy, you know. And then halfway through the set, he went, don't you sing? I was like, looking, but you can't be talking to me. You sing, right?
Oh, my God.
And then I was just like, yeah. And he took gave it to me and started playing Just My Imagination. And it was scary, babe. Because you know what? I have always, you know that song. I know that song. We all know that song, right? Could I remember the words? Let me tell you. All I could remember was at the beginning. So I held the note. So I went, it was just.
We lost that. Right. You killed everything.
Killed everything. You just broke Zoom. Don't apologize to the industries around the world.
Sorry.
A dog's howling in the street out here. It's got
No. It was great, but your phone compressed. It couldn't handle it.
Yeah,
I'm so sorry.
In the background.
We had a glorious Misha Paris note there, and it just...
I tell you what.
It broke the internet.
I tell you what, though. The builders drilling outside your house, Misha, have just stopped.
My dog's making a noise, though. Stop it, Dolly. And basically, I held the note. People thought she was doing a Bill Withers, but it wasn't. It was because I couldn't remember the words. He went nuts. He was like, and he just went into one. And it was one of those moments you never forget. And I was in all the newspapers the next day. And I'm pretty sure that really helped that single.
How did he know who you were?
Do you know, all the years, after that, he called up my management and we met in London. The next time. And then I met him again in LA. He would just find me. He knew where I was. Every time I was somewhere, Prince was on the phone. He just knew. And in the end, I never asked him. This is the thing, because when he was with him, all the years we used to hang out, I did all the talking. He didn't talk much. You know what I mean?
You don't
it was
say
these it. Things where yeah. I mean, it was just like, you know me, I can talk for Britain. I'm like, blah, 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 blah. And then I just remember, anyway, so I'm in LA, it's a few weeks after, and I say to him, I'm at a club actually, and I'm with everyone was there, Eddie Murphy, everyone was hanging out there.
Misha, and, did you not see me outside? I was outside that club.
And there's our running gag.
So sorry, but it sounds like I'm name dropping, but this is exactly what happened. So I'm sat there in the club in LA. Don't ask what club it was. I can't remember what it was called. And I'm sat there, and then this big tall guy walks over and he says to me, Prince would like you to come and sit on his table. And I just thought, oh my gosh, I'm seeing him again. Wow, this is great. So I walked over. There was these two massive guys standing by a table, and they literally parted like the Red Sea. And there was Prince.
Wow.
And he was sat there with this, when I say this girl, was the most beautiful woman you'd ever seen in your life. I mean, she looked like vanity, but she wasn't vanity, but looked like a vanity type, that kind of look. Just stunning. And I'm just thinking, well, I better move out of the way because, you know what I'm saying? And he turned and he went, Misha, come and sit down. And I was like, And then he said to me, he said, you know, I just love your voice. I love your voice. And by the time he said that to me, I didn't have a chance to say, how did you know who I was? Because it was just, I was in awe. And then he said, you know, I really, you know, you remind me of a young Shaka. That was his line. And then he said, and I said, oh, thanks so much. I said, oh, you know, I'm such a fan. And he said, you know, I'd love to work with you. And I said, I'd love you to work with me. I said, that'd be great. And he said, yeah, but right now I'm doing the Batman soundtrack. And I said, oh, don't worry, I'll wait. It's all right.
Yeah, it's fine.
And anyway, so that was that. Went to the hotel room. The next morning, got a phone call about 9 a.m. and it was Prince's management on the phone saying to me, Prince would like to send you over some songs. And I thought it was a hoax. And I said, yeah, send it. Great. How did he know what room I was in? I don't know, because we didn't put my name on the reception, but he knew. He's like that. He was weird like that. He knew stuff.
Yeah, went downstairs. Still ordered breakfast while you're at it. Yeah, sure, send me the songs and I'll take some Eggs Benedict.
And so I went downstairs and there's the songs. It was, you know, it was cassettes back then. And I went and listened to the songs, and the one that I chose was If I Love You Tonight. And then I ended up flying out to Minneapolis after that. And it was a powerful experience. I mean, you know, I was there. He showed me the vault.
I've never been to Paisley Park. Just give us an experience. Is it like Disneyland? That's how I imagine.
No, it isn't. It's not like Disneyland
at all. It's quite bleak, isn't it? It's actually an industrial estate.
It's very industrial. Basically, it's in the middle of a massive field. You know, well, Minneapolis is really green anyway. And you feel like you're in the English countryside. It's just green. And then you've got this white cube kind of building in the middle of all this green. And the best description of it really is like Pinewood. It's that vibe. It's quite industrial. But when you walk in there, it's very futuristic, especially for that time. I mean, no one was really doing that futuristic thing back then, but he was. And you felt like you went into some sort of TARDIS thing. You know, it was huge inside, bigger than what it even looked like outside. And I remember when I was sat waiting for him to come, there was these chairs. And I always tell people about these chairs because I've never seen chairs like this. You sat in the chairs and the chairs move. You bend the chair to what you want them to be. And it was all like Mondrian, you know, the artist.
Yeah.
They were all like that looking and you could bend them. And I spent the whole day like bending and twisting these, but it was wonderful. And then he turned up with the cocoa and I think cream, something, coffee and cream. The two girls, they were his bodyguards.
Oh my word. What an experience.
So, years ago I worked with Candy Dulfer and she told me that she got the call to go and work with Prince at Paisley Park.
Yeah.
And said it was really
great.
She turned up there and he didn't meet her and she was just put into a room and given a pager and just told, you just wait. And she just sat in this room and at 3 a.m., this pager went off. And she had to go down to the studio, and there was Prince.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh God, I must have been lucky then. I was quite lucky then.
You got fast track.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How was it for you being, you know, only 18, 19 and suddenly having this massive hit and, you know, getting, you know, in America as well? And yeah. How did you, this kid from Brixton or Islington,
Broccoli,
wherever you are.
South.
How did you deal with that? And how did your family deal with that? Because you're such a family unit you're grown up in and suddenly you're, you know, superstar.
Yeah. It was really surreal. I mean, I know that it felt like it was a dream because I was worried. I'm going to tell you the truth that when it first kicked off, because it was quick. Yeah. 1 minute, my grandparents were authorizing me to sign this document because I had to have them, you know, I was 17. I was too young. Wow, cool. So I needed them to, I had to beg them to do it and promise them I'd never end up on drugs. That was the line I gave them for them to sign the document so I could have this record deal. Right. And the thing was, I didn't expect it to go so fast. I thought you're going to make this record and then you're going to have to make another one and build it up and build it up. That's what I was thinking. And if I get a little bit of attention on the first one, that's great. But it was so fast. Mm-hmm. Literally 1 minute, I'm begging them to sign the paperwork with me. Next minute, I'm on Top of the Pops. And then my grandparents suddenly were like, oh, it's okay. We believe in you now. It's good because I left art college and all that. I was just getting ready to go to art college and all that. And I gave that all up for that. And they were really, really worried. But when they saw me on the telly, that was it. It was all good.
Yeah. I went back on the phone telling everyone.
Top of the Pops just changed everything. No one ever asked you, even though it's one afternoon's work for £76.25 or something, I believe is what you got. But no one ever hassled you about getting a proper job ever again. It was like seven years of law school in a day.
And
the thing is, get a proper job after that, can you? If you, when you ever watch replays of Top of the Pops and there's some band you hardly remember and it comes on, he is now working in, you know, a bank somewhere, this fella. Everyone's in shock.
Oh my God. I know.
He's Top of the Pops and now he's working in a bank.
I used to see that a lot. I used to see them working in the airport. That was where I remember seeing M. Toomey. Like, amazing. M. Toomey. What, you remember M. Toomey, that band. Great tunes. The guy was like giving me my ticket in Chicago. Do you know what I mean? When I was on tour, I was like, "Whoa!" I was like, "What the hell are you doing there?"
You moved to America, didn't you? Was that a good thing? Was that a scary thing? New York, were you?
Yeah, I lived in New York in 89. Is the first time I went to live there. You know, I literally was just turning 19, I think, and I can't even tell. I had this massive apartment overlooking the Hudson, and above my apartment building was Hemingway's daughter. That's where she died. I used to see her in the lift, you know. And Irene Cara. Yeah, Irene Cara lived down the road from me as well. I mean, it was really surreal. But you had to live there to tour it. America is so big when you tour it, you literally have to stay there. And so I started off, you know, I did David Letterman and all of those massive shows. Huge. I mean, this song really took off, you know. And then I was on tour but before I did the tour, my first gig in America was at Radio City Music Hall with Ashford and Simpson. Yes, sir. And I opened up for Ashford and Simpson. And I have to give you a story about this because it's quite funny. I'm in rehearsal doing the sound check. Well, not rehearsal, sound check. And I'm doing sound check and I'm thinking, this place is massive. My gosh, like, how am I going to, you know? Anyway, so I'm there doing rehearsals. Valerie walks past with Nick and, yes, it's lovely to meet you. Very kind of stoic, bless her. And I just thought, wow, that's Ashley New Simpson, solid as a rock. I'm like freaking out, losing it. It's like, wow, it's amazing. Suddenly, the day after that, we weren't allowed sound check again. How was it? You're not allowed no sound check. You just, that was it. Clearly wasn't a fan of my voice.
Wow.
I tell you?
Did you see the shower room where they cleaned the elephants in Radio City?
No.
This is amazing. This enormous shower room for washing the elephants when they used to.
Really?
Yeah.
Boy, I don't know what I don't remember that. I just my memory of that is the Valerie and Nick story and how the people just went crazy when we started singing because they didn't believe I could. They couldn't believe I was British. You know, that was the thing. How can you be British and sound like that? That was the first thing. So we go, yeah, go ahead. Every song. I'm just like, can't they stop talking while you're singing? They're literally in it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. American audiences, yeah.
And go ahead.
What about your band? Did you take a band with you or was this an American band?
had an American band and they were so good. Oh, yeah, my gosh. And hey, I love my English boys. Don't get twisted. But honey, when you play with an American band, it's a whole nother thing. I mean, these children, they literally all have albums by themselves. They have their own careers. They are... They're all solo acts. Do you know what I mean?
So yeah, yeah.
The level
I know. I've worked with all the top American guys, and it's terrifying. It's just,
no, but they're brilliant. Now, for me, it's amazing. It's because they don't even need a rehearsal. Literally, they've done the homework. They turn up, done, finish, boom. You have to do your homework when you go with them. Do you know what I mean? You know, they know your songs more than you know your songs.
Who was out there with you? Did you not feel lonely? I mean,
I was so lonely. I had my manager out there, Bruce Garfield. He was my American manager. He was with me and I was spending a lot of time with him and his wife and his daughter. They kind of held my hand through that. It was really lonely. In the end, I was so lonely. I literally had to fly my mum over a few times, my sister. I literally needed them there because I was in this big, massive apartment by myself. And it was just, but everyone I knew, I mean, you know, playing Radio City Music Hall, everybody sort of comes to you. I mean, I remember one night came off stage and I remember looking to the side of the stage, there was this tall figure, but I couldn't see the face at the side of the stage. And when I came off the stage, walking towards it, I could see the light hit his face and it was Luther. And Luther Vandross was literally standing watching my whole set. And I was dripping with sweat after the gig, obviously. And I just wanted to, I just grabbed him. I love you. And he said, girl, a little bit wet.
Yeah, mind the jacket. Like,
you went on and you've been after that, you worked with some amazing people. I mean,
Narada. Yeah, come on. So, that next album, you got songs by, and were you working with, you got Narada and Rod Temperton?
Oh, no, you're on the third album. No,
I'm on the third album. Sorry.
The second album.
Are we still on the second? Sorry. Yeah, I know that.
Yeah,
that was the Prince one. But all this Radio Sid and everything, that was off the back of the second album, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I had Nile on there. Nile Rodgers was on the second album.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Nile's on there. Lauryn Hill is on that album before she was Lauryn Hill, basically. I did a bad thing, basically. Like, I went and made my second album completely different to the first one. And my label were really upset with me, basically. But I was on a thing where I'm an artist, you know. I'm all about evolving and growing. So I flew to New York again, went back to live there again, and my American manager held my hand through it. And we found these guys in Brooklyn, and I asked them to write the album with me, which was Contribution. And we recorded it in Unique Studios, and you know, Unique. And so, you know, you'd see everyone in there. And I remember walking in there, and it was a Times Square thing. There was this group of people singing outside, these young people singing. And I remember me and my producer guy, we looked at them and thought, they'd be good on the album, wouldn't they? And we went up to them and we said, do you want to come on the album? And they were like, yeah. And it was like, okay, so they came in. And who was in the choir? Lauren.
Oh, wow.
Lauryn Hill.
Wow.
Lauryn Hill was in the choir. But I didn't know who she was. She was just this little girl with all these, there was like seven or eight of them. But I didn't know it was her. It was only fast forward later, I'm at the Brits, and she's just winning her awards. And she comes up to me, she goes, you don't remember me, do you? And I was like, what? I said, I love you. I said, you're amazing. She said, girl, I'm on your album. I'm singing background vocals on Contribution. And honey, lo and behold, I went back home that night and there she was. Her name was there. I had no...
Oh, wow. She didn't have an invoice or something. It wasn't something terrible like that.
But you see, she wasn't known then. You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I had Rakim on there as well, from Eric B and Rakim. I had everyone on that record, and it was you know, back at Gary, you know how it is. You know, back then you had to make every album the same. It was one of those things, and I kind of went against the grain with that. But I just thought, because I was being what an artist is, I was just exploring, you know.
Yeah, but I get that as well, and it goes back to you pushing against your grandparents and trying to get out and do something different, and that's your nature, isn't it, to try? I mean, you've surprised people throughout all your career, you know, suddenly being an actor, being a presenter, whatever it might be. You know, you're not always trying to fit into what people want and see you as.
No, because I don't actually care about what people think of me, because if you do that, you're finished. You know, for me, it's all about the creativity. You know, I just want to inspire with whatever I do. Clearly, you know, I think that's the church thing. It's still that thing there. It's still there where I just want people to feel inspired. You've got to raise the consciousness of humanity, you know, with what we do. Otherwise, there's no point, is there? You know, you can't just do it for self-gratification. That's just boring, isn't it? It's habit.
True enough. But so let's go to this third album then. So come on, Narada, Michael Walden and Rod Temperton.
Just pick up on that, because Rod Temperton, who he is, you know, he wrote songs, great songs for Michael Jackson. I mean, go through, what's the list, guy?
It's from Cleethorpes, and he joined this band Heatwave, and he wrote Boogie Nights and
Always and Forever.
And he got spotted by Quincy Jones really early on, and and went and wrote loads of songs on Off the Wall. I think did he write Blame?
Well, he wrote Thriller.
And then, but then I was getting to that.
Sorry.
And then he wrote Thriller. Yeah, well, he wrote like three or four songs on Thriller, and it was just this lovely, quiet northern bloke, wasn't he? And he was called the Invisible Man.
Don't make Rod to be that this meek guy. Rod was listening.
The documentary about him was literally called The Invisible Man. It's not me.
No, he didn't like to have like be in the public. He didn't want that. But him as a person, he was really like charismatic. You know, don't mess around with Rod. Rod was hardcore. Rod was
how did he write? What was it like in a room with him?
Well, let me just tell you how it first happened. So basically, I flew to LA to work with him because I love Always and Forever. That's like my song.
Yeah,
it wasn't even Thriller. For me, it was Always and Forever. What a tune. And so when I turned up, it was the riots, actually. It all kicked off. I didn't realize the riots were happening. I literally just arrived. Do you see what I'm like? Everything with me is like a drama. So I turn up, I get into the hotel. I'm looking at the news and I'm thinking, wow, there's some real big riots in LA at the moment. People are really getting crazy. There's a couple of buildings on fire. Didn't think nothing of it. And, knackered.
Was this Rodney
Suddenly
King?
The phone rings.
Rodney King time, is it?
Yeah. So the phone rings. I pick it up. Make sure it's Rod. And he's got a really thick northern accent, like proper northern accent, right? Goes, you've got to come out the hotel now. And I'm like, what? What do you mean? I just got here. He goes, I've got the driver. I've sent the driver over to you now. Your building next door to you is on fire. I mean, wait a second. Is that the building that's on the TV right now? Yes.
did you not see me outside?
It's terrible. So basically, I ran down with the bags, get in the car. The car is swerving in between fires on the street. It was you could make it up. He's up in Mulholland Drive. Yeah? So I get to Mulholland Drive and I turn up, I knock the door, and he goes, oh, thank God you're all right. And he goes, now what do you want? That's the first thing Rod said to me. What do you want?
And I said, did he mean in terms of song or a cup of tea?
It wasn't like coming another cup
of fire.
He goes, What do you want? Just like that. That's how Rod is. He was really yeah. like, you know, hardcore. It, you know, black and white, no gray. And I just went, well, I really want you to get me a song like Always and Forever. And I know that really moved him, because everybody was kind of asking him for Michael Jackson stuff. And here I was asking him for something that he's beginning, basically. Yeah, yeah. And I knew I got him at that point. He was melting. Do you know what I mean? Bless him. And then he said, okay, give me a couple of days. So I stayed with them and I stayed at their house because Mulholland
on
is
fire.
So high up. Yeah. And also Mulholland is so far up. You literally have a view of the whole of LA. So, you know, we saw all the fires and everything, but we were up the top. And I stayed there. And 4 days later, he came in with this song called You Put a Move on My Heart. That song is unbelievable. It's such a great song. Yeah. And that started our friendship. And Rod and I made an album 2 years ago, just before he died, and it hasn't come out.
Oh,
that's how long our friendship went on for. Oh. I don't know, but Rod and I and Kathy, his wife, you know, we were friends for, well, up to his death.
Well, no, I just wondered if you sat in the room while Rod was writing. Did you ever watch him write?
Yeah. But the first, because, you know, that wasn't, he wrote four songs on that album, you know. We were in the studio with the other ones. Yeah, he's got a little keyboard. And, you know, it's the process of talking. You know, first we talk about the stuff that's going on with me. He's very much that kind of, he's very much like Pete Bell, the same way that they, you know, they sit down and you talk with them about what's going on with your life. Remember, you're their muse. It's that kind of vibe where, you know, you co-write in the way of your story.
Yeah, so you're singing your song, which is pretty
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so me and him are there. I'm telling him about what's going on with whatever's going on with me at the time. And this inspires him then to, you know, start the chord process, and he writes with the piano first because he's a proper keyboard man, really. And that's how he starts the process, and that's how we started the first song anyway. And then after that, we were in the studio every single day, and I think it was four songs, and I stayed with him for that. But he's not like Nada had a team of people working with him, Rod is by himself. Right. Rod is literally one man band in his room, well, a very big room, and massive. And he's by himself with his keys.
Misha, we have to, yeah, we have to jump a little bit because of
go.
Yeah,
and you take on acting as well at some point in your career, and you end up doing
like
music.
You.
And, well, like me, yeah. I mean, I sort of started doing that as a kid in Islington with Anna Scher, but you, this would have been new for you, right? So how did that
yeah.
come about? And how did it feel?
Well, the thing is, I wasn't that new to it. It was 94 that I got my first role in a theatre production. It was Clark Peters that put me on this show called Sweet Lorraine. But no, so he was the one that put me forward for that. And that was my first sort of venture into acting. I was terrified of acting, as I still am. It's not like I'm over it. I'm still like, but as I said, the only reason why I've ended up doing loads of things is because I'm not scared to look like an idiot. Do you know, I'm not afraid to look silly, but I'll only do it once. And if I'm really rubbish at something, I'll never do it again. But that was my sort of entry into it. And then I ended up doing Chicago. And then I did.
Could you play in Chicago? Mama
Morton. Yeah. Morton. I played Mama Morton. And I did that. And then I did, what else did I do? Oh, I've done so many theatre productions. And then I did Fame. Sorry, I did Fame. I was in Fame for like 2 years.
Yeah. I've got a suspicion that it really appealed to you because in a way it's a bit like the old church group that you belong to, you know, where you're turning up. And what I love about theatre is the family that you end up having around you. And you're all sitting in the same space if you're doing a musical, but you're all taking great risks in front of each other. And it's all for the higher purpose, isn't it?
It is. It's. I was really lucky with Fame because I had a really good bunch of people. They were just, I mean, was it Georgie Porter, who's amazing. She's such a fantastic girl, and all the people in the cast were fantastic. It's lovely if you get a good cast. You know, it can all go the other way if they're not.
It's the same as a band. It's the same as a band.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. But it was great. I had a great time with them. And the thing was, for me, I'm going to say, really, it's about being able to sing every night. I get off on that. Mm-hmm. I need to be singing all the time. When I'm singing, as I told you, I'm literally in another place. I'm gone. I'm not there. Yeah.
Yeah. So your theatre thing has to involve singing, right? Doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm not about the straight stuff. No. I've done it. I've done a bit of straight stuff. I did Agatha Christie. I was like, I was a villain in that, in Agatha Christie. And in EastEnders, I was a villain in that as well. Absolutely terrified, Gary. Let me tell you, I was literally wearing a nappy. I was terrified. I'm like,
and did you?
What are you doing, Mish? What are you doing?
But that's exactly what I was going to ask you about, because is there, you know, I like doing what you do. You know, I like doing jumping ship and doing other things. And is there an element of you that thinks what I really want to be doing is making records and maybe I shouldn't be over in this? Or is it all entertainment for you and you're enjoying plugging into all these different things and challenging yourself?
I like to challenge myself because I think that the process of making records can become incredibly boring. To come back to it after I've gone off and done a Radio 2 series or a TV or a film, I come back to music and I feel like I'm new again with the music again. It feels new. It feels like I'm doing a new thing. It's fresh. I think when it becomes that kind of, you know, the process, you write the songs, you make the record, then you have then you wear a nappy because you wonder if people are going to love it. And then you've got to go all over the telly and try and promote it and try and get a telly to promote it. It's, you know, our age, it's not easy. And then, you know, then you go on tour and then you do it all again.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, anything that feels monotonous, I start to die inside. For me, when I go back to music, which is every couple of years, it's always like, oh, yes. Oh gosh, this is why I do what I do. And I fall in love with it again. And it feels like I'm a virgin going into it again. And here I am, you know, 34 years later. It still feels fresh as a daisy. You know, I just literally came off of tour with Fame when I went, and well, COVID came after that. But then I came off tour with Fame, went straight to Memphis, shot this documentary, The Gospel.
Oh, yeah, that was talking about Misha. Yeah.
And when that came out, Warner came and asked me to sign to make a record and to make, you know, some records with them. That's how that all happened. I wasn't planning on putting out a record. It all happened after the documentary.
And that, yeah, and how did that feel? Because this is about the story of Gospel, right? The documentary thing that you did. And how did that feel like a real sort of coming home? I mean, did that sort of tidy totally. Things up for you, going back to where you started?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I felt like I had to pay homage to my grandparents. I felt they never, you know, they were proud of me, but they always wanted me to make a gospel record that I didn't make while they were alive. I felt like I had to. It was a thing I felt inside. I wanted to. I dedicated the whole album to them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and I kept my promise. I didn't end up in rehab. And it was a real coming home for me in that way. I managed to keep my promise to them because I kept saying to them, I'm not. Just sign the paper. I promise I'm never going to become. Yeah, my granddad was like, you're going to end up in the pit of hell. You're going to be a harlot. I remember having to look up the words. Because I was like, what's a harlot? But, you know.
Yeah, that's in Essex, isn't it?
Right? And so I remember like making this album thinking, wow, I kept my promise. It's not easy to do that in this business.
But it's a big, powerful record as well. For it's not sort of happy clappy gospel, isn't it? There's some really weighty stuff on it. I mean, it's brilliant, but
yeah, thank
and you've
you.
Taken
thank
non-gospel you. Songs and given yeah. gospel feel and changed the lyrics in that sense. The lyrics now take on a slightly different meaning in a way.
Yeah, because to me, this was always the point I was trying to relate to my grandparents, was that it's all his, you know, her, whatever you want, whatever God is to you, the divine spirit or whatever you want to call it. I believe everything belongs to that power. These songs, like Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. I mean, that, if that's not an inspirational record, come on. Yeah. Do you know? And you know, I Want to Know What Love Is. I mean, these songs growing up, I mean, you know, we're 80s children, you know? And I've got to tell you, those songs blew me away when I heard them the first time. And I remember thinking, I want to make music like that. You know what I'm saying? And I'm going back in the 80s now. Because it's inspirational. So to me, my point in this album as well, not just to give grandma and grandpa, you know, respect and thanks for giving me such good moral values growing up that kept me in this really topsy-turvy industry. Trust me, it's not easy. But without their, you know, structure that they gave me, I couldn't have survived that. But also to show people that you don't have to be religious to be inspired. Mm-hmm. You know, something moves you because a great lyric does that. It gives you that same feeling like a spiritual song will give you. You see what I'm saying? Because it's all saying pretty much the same thing. So that was my reasons for choosing those songs, because that's what they are to me. They speak to me, you know?
Yeah, I think that was what I was saying earlier when I was saying, did your gospel training, your church training allowed you to sing secular songs plugged into your spiritual side much?
Yeah, you're right. You said
we're all so cynical, aren't we? We're all so cynical about music often. Yeah. I mean, especially as musicians, I know I am. I judge everything technically when I listen to it. I rarely let things get under my skin as much as I used to as a kid.
Yeah.
And I think I need to relearn how to do that properly.
But also the thing about it is, you see, this is why I used to have a lot of, you know, we're talking about this, there's a lot of female issues going on within the music industry right now as we're presently talking. There's a lot of dramas going on, and I go back to the times when I was in the studio with people working with them and I wasn't valued a lot of the time because I was a female, because I was basically saying that to very trained musicians who I'd be working with, you know, at these big studios and you know, Barnes or wherever, the Air Studios, whatever, you know, big studios. You know, I'm working with these really, like, these guys have been to Guildhall and all these, you know, Berkeley and all these, like, music schools. And here I am, you know, never, can't even read music, but I write from here. You know, it's, everything is in my head. I hum the parts out to musicians. I start with the bass and then I go with the keys and I hum everything out and they copy what I do. That's how I write. And then I put the lyrics at the end. And so I would have fights with a lot of the musicians because they were like, that doesn't make sense. I said, I know it doesn't make sense, but just do it. But then they don't want me to know that it's all right because I'm a chick. You know, it was that. I used to fight with that. When I was a younger musician, it was really tough being a woman, knowing what you wanted to write, you know, with people who are trained.
You know, we have to say congratulations to you on your MBE, which you got last.
Thank you.
Obviously, more than just your contribution to music, because your contribution to charity and to, you know, to a lot of issues that young people have growing up, you know, and you've been outspoken about all of that. That must have been such an honour if your grandparents were still around.
You know, that's the only thing, you know. I mean, the closest thing we got to that was, I remember doing a private concert for Princess Diana and Charles, and my grandmother, I dragged her with me.
And, wow.
And I never forget that Princess Diana, well, you know, when you have to stand up in a line and you have to wait for them to come over, and she came over, she was so moved that my grandmother was there. she had a massive bouquet of flowers that was hers, and she gave it to my grandmother and told her, you've done such a fabulous job. And my grandmother kept those flowers to the day she died. She literally had them in her Bible pressed.
That's wonderful.
Stuff like that's powerful.
And under the lockdown, who gave you your MBE?
We haven't had the ceremony yet because of lockdown. Will. I think they're looking at the summer this year, from what I've been told. Like,
Misha, if I'm outside, will you let me in?
I love you, Gary. You're so brilliant.
Misha, thank you so much.
Yeah, this has been brilliant. No, it's so lovely to see you. Lovely to see you.
It's so good to see you. Yeah. I mean, we need to get in the studio, all of us, and write a tune.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? That'd be brilliant. Oh, that was, what a delight.
Yeah, that really cheered us all up, didn't it?
It certainly did.
There's this beautiful person she is. She really is. So full of enthusiasm, inspiring.
Yeah, after all this time, not like us jaded, bitter old hacks.
Well, it has made me want to go back and listen to you too, and maybe not. No, I apologise. Well, listen, thank you for listening, and thank you for joining us on our regular podcast. We love doing this, so keep leaving lovely reviews or whatever you leave.
Yes, thanks to Ben, our producer, and thanks to Misha for being amazing. And so it's good night from me.
And it's good night for all of them.